From Alaska to Florida, Alabama to Illinois, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Biden has compared Georgia's election reforms to Jim Crow laws. But what were Jim Crow laws and who enacted them? Jeff Lord from the American Spectator is here with the answer. House Republican leadership and the Freedom Caucus are at odds over some rule changes that benefit the Democrat majority. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Federal Drug Administration is proposing new rules for cigarettes. Eric Boehm and Guy Bentley of Reason Magazine explain why they are likely to be counterproductive to public health. And Major League Baseball's first at-bat in political correctness has resulted in a strikeout. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Georgia recently passed a number of election law reforms designed to ensure the integrity of future elections. But the law has been demagogued by the left as a Jim Crow law. It's all part of a push to give Democrats a permanent majority in the federal government. Here to explain all of this is Jeff Lord. Jeff is a contributing editor to the American Spectator and previously served in the Reagan White House. Jeff, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jeff, as we look at the agenda of the Democrats in Congress, you have a move to pack the Supreme Court of the United States. You have H.R. 1, which would essentially federalize the operation of elections, a move toward D.C., Puerto Rico, statehood. We could go on and on. Is there some common link between all of these proposed policies?
Absolutely, Loman. What this is all about, and it's frightening in a very real way, is Democrats want to gain absolute power in perpetuity in this country. And by federalizing elections and lifting it out of the control of the 50 different states, by packing the Supreme Court with four new justices, by adding two new states that would produce four new Democratic senators, this is all about complete and total control of the United States of America and making the Republican Party a permanent minority party with any ability to get elected here, because they would close it off. And when you add into that the fact that they overwhelmingly control the mainstream media, that their allies and their members in Congress are trying to get Fox News, Newsmax, and One America News taken off of television carriers around the country, when you realize the power of the American left in academia, Hollywood, I mean, this is a pretty tight grip here all on one side of the line, and it's not good.
Impacting particularly H.R. 1 and the election process, as you've brought up here, Jeff, the state of Georgia has passed a number of election reforms, which are being portrayed as draconian. In fact, the President of the United States has declared it a Jim Crow law. Now, I'd like you to, first of all, explain what a Jim Crow law was and exactly which party enacted those laws.
Jim Crow laws were shorthand, and there was an actual historical figure or fantasy of a figure who was very much in favor of segregation. And so the Jim Crow name of this person, this fictional person, was lifted, as I recall, onto Jim Crow laws. And the Jim Crow laws segregated America. They were the creation of the Democratic Party. They were enacted in the post-Civil War era. They segregated public schools, public transportation, restaurants, restrooms, public places in general, everything from water coolers to beaches. Rosa Parks now has a statue in the U.S. Capitol, and she, of course, is the famous civil rights heroine from the late 1950s. But nobody seems to remember why and how she became that heroine. She sat in the front of a whites-only bus, where instead of going to the back of the bus, well, who segregated the bus? It was the local Democratic Party and their officials. Everybody seems to forget that Bull Connor, the infamous Birmingham police chief with the dogs and fire hoses, was a member of two other organizations. One was the Democratic National Committee, as a committeeman from Alabama, and the other was the Ku Klux Klan. The Democratic Party, as I have said over and over and over again, was built on race. Let us not forget that this was the party put together initially by slave owners. Small historical note is the Democrats were the first political party to write a party platform, and the first one was in 1840. They wrote in their first six platforms from 1840 to 1860 staunch support for slavery. Yes, indeed. And I might add, Lohman, there's been no apology to this day with this, which is why I'm somewhat amused. There are 175 Democrats in the U.S. House this minute who are sponsoring a commission on reparations. And good old Republican Congressman Louie Gohmert from Texas has taken them up on this and has attached an amendment to their commission bill in which he wants an apology from the Democratic Party on slavery and demands that reparations be paid by the Democratic Party. I suspect that's not going to go very far with these self-same Democrats, but Congressman Gohmert is 100% correct about all of this. In short, the Democratic Party, as I've often said, they've moved from supporting slavery to segregation to, in today's world, identity politics, which I refer to as the son of segregation. And they just never end. They are intent on dividing people by race. And they do it all the time, and it's going to continue, and it needs to be fought.
Given this history, as we look at the Georgia election reform laws that were passed, actually, there is a group of ministers, I believe, individuals of color, who have said that this new Georgia law actually empowers black voters. Can you tell us a bit about that?
First of all, I think Sunday voting is a big deal and in Georgia. And this Georgia law makes it easy for voters on Sunday. And, of course, one of the big factors in the South is the black church. And these black clergy put out a statement condemning all these people moving things out of Georgia in reaction to this, and they went through the specifics about Sunday voting and one drop mail box, official place so that people can vote by a drop-off mailbox. I mean, what they're doing with this law is fighting, in a very real sense, voter suppression, because if you've got people who are not identified properly voting, you are, of course, suppressing the vote of somebody who's gone to great lengths to do it. And one of the things they have in there, of course, is voter ID. And I must say, it just makes you don't know whether to laugh or cry. All this criticism of voter ID, when, of course, as any sentient person knows, you got to have a photo ID to buy a bottle of booze. You got to have it to get on an airplane, a train, Major League Baseball in a huff, move the All-Star game out of Atlanta. But if you want to pick up your baseball tickets at will call, you've got to produce a photo ID. I mean, the hypocrisy of this is just mind-boggling. Coca-Cola, which is headquartered in Atlanta, made a big deal about this, and then it comes out that, yep, you got to have a photo ID to get into their shareholders meeting. Delta, similarly, headquartered in Atlanta, yeah, they are very upset about this, but you got to have a photo ID to get on a Delta airplane. The hypocrisy here knows no bounds, and the bottom line is they are badly damaging, to the tune, I think I saw, of about $100 million, Georgia and the African-American community in Georgia, which is about, in terms of minority businesses in Atlanta, about 30%. And they're going to be seriously hurt by all of this. I mean, and the hypocrisy of it is just stunning.
We have been talking with Jeff Lord. Jeff is a contributing editor at American Spectator, formerly served in the Reagan White House, going back a number of years now as a deputy political director. He has a podcast and a website. Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about those so folks can go and get, as you put it, the word of the Lord.
The word of the Lord is the name of my podcast, and you can find me for sure at thejeffreylord.com, which is my website and blog posting site, and we get all kinds of things there from myself and various contributors. There's also, you can find links to the podcast there as well. So come on in, the water is fine.
Jeff Lord, always good to have you with us. We'll look forward to having you back soon. Take care.
You bet. Thanks, Lohman. Bye-bye.
Scott Parkinson, as always, at the Club for Growth, and he keeps an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C. for us. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
There has been a lot of activity in the U.S. House of Representatives this past week, Scott, and a bit of discontent among some Republican members as to how their own leadership is handling things. Tell us a bit of background here. What's going on?
Yeah, so this all kind of folds back to when Pelosi won the majority in the speakership back in 2018. At the time in the new Congress in 2019 and 2020, Republicans used a procedural tool to force votes on controversial issues to basically put the Democrats in a bind and extract a political vote or, you know, maybe a win on policy here and there. And these are called motions to recommit. So when the Democrats organized underneath the 117th Congress this January, they changed the rules of the House in preventing Republicans from offering motions to recommit. And so what you've seen in more recent weeks is members from the House Freedom Caucus really coming together and organizing on the House floor around the idea that members actually need to conduct roll call votes and not pass things underneath a voice vote where nobody knows exactly who supports or opposes these so-called non-controversial bills that are brought underneath a suspension of the House rules. When a bill is brought before the House underneath suspension, it needs a two-third majority to be passed, and then it's obviously still sent over to the Senate. Usually the Senate passes a lot of things by unanimous consent that are non-controversial. So this is kind of like how those post office renaming get accomplished or other non-controversial administrative bills through the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, they have a lot of things that actually do pass through the suspension of the rules in this fashion. But these House conservatives and the Freedom Caucus have said, listen, you've taken away some of our minority rights, and what we're going to do is force roll call votes on non-controversial items. So sometimes they'll request a recording vote and it'll still pass overwhelmingly. And other times you're able to prevent the legislation from moving forward. So this week, what we saw was Steny Hoyer, the majority leader for the House Democrats, make a new rule in order to put all the non-controversial bills together into one vote. Because during COVID, all the votes are generally 30 minutes long. And they wanted to pass 16 bills this week, so that would have taken members being on the floor for over 8 hours in order to pass these non-controversial bills that would only have a few members opposing them. So for the first time, they considered these suspension votes in block underneath the rule of the House. And what it did was actually divide the House conservatives with the House Republican leadership on how to proceed and how to adjudicate non-controversial legislation. We had 67 Republicans, and we also had two Democrats vote against that suspension in block that passed 16 non-controversial bills. But it's more symbolic of minority rights in the House. I think that your listeners all throughout the country expect people to take a vote and to be on the record for where they stand on issues. And some of these issues that come before the House of Representatives are fairly controversial. They had the Safe Banking Act, which basically is a financial regulation for the banking of marijuana companies. This is a bill that's also passed the previous Congress, and they brought it up earlier this week where it passed on a controversial vote with about 325 members of the House of Representatives supporting it. So that wasn't included in this tranche of 16 non-controversial bills, but it is demonstrative of the idea that they can pass things underneath suspension of the rules and pass them quickly when they have a two-third majority. And so what I think the House Republicans and House conservatives wanted to demonstrate is that the suspension of the rule votes aren't always non-controversial, and sometimes they're used in order to jam conservatives and really accommodate expediency in passing legislation.
Scott, is this not an age-old problem for Republicans where leadership often goes along and makes deals with Democrats while conservatives are left to fight that sort of an effort? And you know, we see Democrats, they always stick together. They never splinter. They always cast their votes in unison. But Republicans never quite seem to get on the same page. Why is that?
I think it is a signal that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are strong leaders. And in order to keep your side together, you also need to get buy-in from the membership, and you need to protect their individual rights. I think that most members want those rights protected. In this instance, I think you're seeing Republican leadership feeling like they're close to winning back the House majority. And so they're thinking, well, when we have the majority and we want to pass bills underneath suspension of the rules, we might not do it in block, but we're going to want the Democrats to accommodate us and not call roll call votes on every single item. It'll slow things down. It'll be bad for our governing strategy. And so I think that's why the House leadership from the Republicans went along with Steny Hoyer in allowing for these bills to pass underneath the suspension of the rules. And I look at the way that the conservatives have a role in the House as really being the compass of the direction of the conference.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're a 501c4 issue advocacy organization. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
With new rules on cigarettes being considered by the Food and Drug Administration, there are those questioning whether they would actually improve public health. Eric Boehm and Guy Bentley of Reason Magazine explain.
I regret to inform you that the Food and Drug Administration is at it once again. Yes, the FDA has yet to fully explain away all of the mistakes it made in handling the coronavirus pandemic, but that won't stop the FDA, our public health experts, from writing new rules for cigarettes that could end up actually undermining public health for lots of current smokers. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Guy Bentley. He is the Director of Consumer Freedom for the Reason Foundation, a colleague of mine. He joins us now on the phone to talk about these new proposed rules that were revealed by the Wall Street Journal earlier this week in a good bit of journalism. Guy, thanks for taking some time and joining us here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the FDA says that they're considering, I guess, I mean, none of this is final yet. We should be clear about that up front. But there's a number of new rules for cigarettes that are under consideration. Let's start with the really one that jumped off the page to me, which is this idea of limiting the amount of nicotine in cigarettes. I guess, like, ostensibly the idea here is to make cigarettes less addicting. But of course, you've got a lot of people who are addicted to them who want that nicotine.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Eric. This has been an idea that's been batting around in the tobacco control community really for around three decades now. And as you say, the idea sounds relatively simple. It's to massively reduce the amount of nicotine in cigarettes to make them minimally or non-addictive. The idea being that people who start smoking are less likely to continue smoking, and that those who do smoke right now will eventually stop smoking or switch to a less harmful alternative. Now, the obvious problem with that is that it's a not-so-stealthy way of just a prohibition of cigarettes. Just by analogy, if you mandated that the content of alcohol in a bottle of liquor had to be reduced to something that was minimally or non-intoxicating, say 1 or 2%, alcohol content, nobody would really consider that liquor, and you would most certainly see people finding alternatives, most likely on the black market, to fulfill that product that had already been prohibited. There has been some modeling done on this policy. An FDA-funded study published several years ago estimated that around 5 million smokers would quit in the first year of this policy being introduced. Now, that is a wildly optimistic scenario, and essentially how they got there was essentially just by asking eight experts in the field of tobacco control to basically just guess what they think would happen. Not a very scientific way to go about this kind of policy.
Yeah, and even if you do get that optimistic outcome, right, even if you do get 5 million people to quit, there's something like 34 million, 35 million smokers in this country right now. Like, what do the other 30 million do if they don't quit? I imagine you're going to need to light up 5 cigarettes or something to get the hit of nicotine that you get now from one, which means 5 times as much tar, 5 times as much smoke in your lungs, all of that. It seems like some obvious problems there. You also mentioned the prohibition angle, and I think the comparison to liquor is an important one and a good one here, right? Like, people have an addiction to nicotine. They're going to want to feed that addiction. That demand will be met one way or another, right?
That's exactly right. And the point you bring up about substitution is very important. There have been experiments done on trying to use groups of smokers and switch them to low nicotine cigarettes. And in several studies, there it is shown that smokers do substitute by smoking even more cigarettes, which is, as you point out, even worse for their health. And in some, they do reduce the number of cigarettes they smoke, but most of them do not quit. And we should also point out that the FDA assumed in their modeling that that consumers would have access, free access, to a wide range of reduced risk products like e-cigarettes. But the FDA has been waging a huge war on e-cigarettes and the safer nicotine alternative. So that's not a scenario you can bank on either.
Yeah, you can switch to the safer product if you can afford them or if you can find one once the FDA gets done making them as expensive and difficult to buy as possible. We're talking with Guy Bentley. He is the Director of Consumer Freedom for the Reason Foundation, and talking about these proposed new rules. Now, none of this is final, again, we have to say, and hopefully never will be. One of the other things, Guy, I wanted to touch on before we let you go here is that the FDA is also reportedly considering banning menthol cigarettes or menthol additives to cigarettes. And that's something that, like, raises some really interesting questions about criminal justice issues because of the population of people that tend to use menthol cigarettes.
It's completely true that the vast majority of Black American smokers use menthol cigarettes, around 80%. But what's often not reported is that the percentage of Black adults who smoke is basically just the same as white adults. And in fact, Black youth smoke at lower rates than white youth. So prohibiting this kind of cigarette is almost a laser-guided attack on Black American smokers. And of course, we've seen from other previous prohibitions, like the war on drugs and alcohol and gambling and so on, minorities are disproportionately impacted by those prohibitions. So the illusion that this will be positive for racial justice in America is a complete illusion. What you would have is even more over-criminalization and targeting of minority communities.
It just creates another opportunity for the police to stop people in certain communities, people that look a certain way, and say, hey, you know, what's that in your pocket there? Are those illegal menthol cigarettes, right? Just creates another opportunity for those interactions. So many of those interactions that we've seen that don't end well.
And it's extraordinary that a new administration, the Biden administration, allegedly touting its progressive credentials, is really becoming a prohibition administration if these proposals go forward, combined with the president's refusal to support marijuana legalization. So we're in a very odd place where an allegedly progressive administration is pursuing a raft of prohibitionist policies.
We are unfortunately out of time for today. That is Guy Bentley from the Reason Foundation. Guy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You can check out more of Guy's work at Reason.org. That's the foundation side of the operation. Check out my work at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Major League Baseball's decision to move the All-Star Game out of Atlanta in protest over that state's election laws is the latest example of why sports should stay out of politics. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For an example of how poisonous politics can become, look at the rancid politicization of baseball. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred pulled the All-Star Game out of Atlanta because of his unquestioned acceptance of one side's ideological framing of Georgia's new election integrity law. That law seeks, among other things, something long supported by huge majorities of Americans of all races, colors, creeds, and that is the common sense step of requiring voters to provide some form of ID. Major League Baseball actually believes in IDs too. In fact, you need an ID to pick up your tickets or buy a beer at a baseball game. Here's an experiment for you. Go to the pickup window of your local ballpark this summer and tell the ticket person you forgot your ID. Good luck getting the tickets you paid for. And yet, Major League Baseball cries foul if a state asks for your ID before you vote. Instead, MLB is moving the game to Denver, where, as Georgia Governor Brian Kemp has observed with irony, quote, Georgia has 17 days of in-person early voting, including two optional Sundays. Colorado has 15. They also have a photo ID requirement, so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, unquote. Well, but it does make sense, said Kemp, if people are whipped up into believing just the opposite, when they're misled about what's happening in Georgia. Kemp called out Stacey Abrams and President Biden. And how odd that Kemp is the target of this. Liberals vilifying Governor Kemp might want to recall that it was the same group of Georgia Republicans that actually infuriated Trump supporters by not giving them what they wanted in terms of fully investigating voting fraud allegations in the November election. The goodwill of Governor Kemp and friends should have earned some trust among progressives. Well, it wasn't long-lived. As for Major League Baseball Commissioner Manfred, he has accepted an ideological caricature of Georgia's election law by its Democratic Party opponents, who denounced it as racist. For that reason, he yanked the All-Star game. What's especially ironic about that move is that Atlanta, which has a majority black population, is arguably the most thriving city in America for black Americans and minority-owned businesses. This boycott by MLB, whose headquarters distantly sit up north in New York City, will cost African Americans in Georgia literally tens of millions of dollars. It will be economically devastating to black people in Atlanta. By the way, Denver has a much smaller minority population. This action doesn't only hurt economically. Blacks in the South have long sought political enfranchisement. Election integrity laws do that. In fact, there can be few things as frustrating, i.e. a feeling of political disenfranchisement, as your vote being canceled out by ballots for which the integrity can't be assured. Majority of blacks and whites alike have long supported the common sense step of requiring voters to provide some form of ID. Incidentally, some actually believe that Georgia's new ID laws are too lax. For instance, according to Georgia's Secretary of State, absentee ballots can be cast without a photo ID. Voters can instead use a photocopy of a bank statement, a utility bill, a paycheck stub, or the last four digits of a Social Security number, or several added options. How repressive is that? Your vote needs to count. It needs to count regardless of your skin color. And in the South, that has been especially important. And yet, Democrats frame the Georgia bill in just the opposite manner, viciously casting it as racist. Such over-the-top vitriol serves to intimidate corporations and organizations alike, like Major League Baseball. So thus, MLB, an organization with expertise not in ballots but balls and strikes, crossed the line. It stuck its nose into a political debate where it has no expertise and no place. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot have an America where sports organizations like Major League Baseball and the NFL and the NBA, among others, make sports decisions based on partisan debates among politicians. It's outrageous. Enough already. And as for me, MLB, you can call me out. I'm not watching a single game this year. Enough is enough. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHTU-FM and WKHF-FM in Lynchburg, Virginia, along with WANB-FM in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal, American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.